It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Hopefully this is working. I think it's working. Okay, good.
Well, once again, the little thing I select for the input has changed. Yeah. And so I'm like, I think this is the one. Because it's never something simple like your damn mixer or your computer speakers. It's always USB audio codec, blah, 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 and, you know. Anyway. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that is to the rest of the internet as chicken is to opera. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 206.
And Ezzy's also here, for now. We're just talking about Ezzy's infatuation with William. We're not sure if they have a special bond that can last beyond death, or if it's because William's literally the only person who comes and visits our house, and so...
She pretty much ignores me once I'm here, I mean...
Well, yeah, that's part of the game.
Oh.
She's being coy. Except when she hasn't eaten for a while, and then she crawls all over you, remember?
Well, that's true.
Yeah, she's just come off of a hunger strike a couple days ago, so she's a little more calm now. The other day, I was trying to explain her to someone, and I said, yeah, and she's a terrible person. And they said, what? And I said, my cat, she's a terrible person. They said, we're talking about your cat, right? Like, yeah, she's also a terrible cat, but she's a terrible person.
As persons go.
Yes. So here we are, Peter's Donuts. For those of you just joining us for the first time ever, welcome.
Welcome.
Also, let me give you the rundown.
Not run you down, just give you the rundown of how the show works. He's not going to get in a car, find you while you're walking down the street to run you down. I just want to make sure everybody knows that. I wouldn't want anyone to be nervous before they even get to start listening to our show.
Way to paint me into a corner. Anyway, instead, I'll just tell you how the show works. We have a hat. It's magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People who need to listen. I don't know. I've done the people who need people jokes, so at the last moment I bailed
twice,
out.
I think. Yeah.
I bailed out, but I didn't have anywhere to go, so I'm just flailing my arms in midair, watching the ground get closer. Anyway, those people, you, right now, who's listening, email that address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, little comments, topics, questions, usually questions,
brief.
Sometimes topics, brief. Not a lot of comments. Mostly topics and questions. Anyway, to the hat, to the email address that it belongs to the hat, and the hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. It's echolocating servants, draw those out from the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour, that's the show. As he's being really annoying, and doesn't help that she's loving on the USB cord that connects us to the mixer.
Something bad's going to happen, I just feel it.
Well, I think there's a train coming by, I think she's hearing that too. You just mean in life?
Or? No, I just, like, she's going to step on the computer and turn everything off, and we're going to have to start over.
Yep.
As has
so don't get too into this line here, people, because it's not going to be here. You won't have heard this, so don't try not to enjoy it. That's weird. So, William, how was your week? Before you answer, I'm going to take it as a given that your week was cold, because it's freaking cold.
Well, I wasn't outside very much, actually.
It's cold enough I don't even have to be outside for it to be cold.
Well, there was Valentine's Day, which...
Oh, yeah.
Which...
I always forget about Valentine's Day.
For some reason, I was very sentimental about it this year. Because Valentine's Day meant something very specific to me when I was growing up, and I was very disappointed when I got to be, like, in junior high to realize that for the rest of the world, Valentine's Day wasn't like that at all. Because when you're a little kid in elementary school, at least in Melcher in the 70s and 80s, Valentine's Day, you buy little Valentines for all of your classmates.
In almost all situations, you have to give them to all your classmates or none.
All your classmates. Now, this is the thing about that. First of all, it doesn't matter if it's a girl or a boy, or, you know, if it's someone that you are attracted to or whatever. You're giving it to everybody. And also, this is the key thing for me, is, you know, some kids would not actually, maybe their parents, they would look over their shoulder and make sure they filled out a Valentine for every kid, but they'd throw it away on the way to school or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or they, you know, they just give the kid the Valentine because that's what they were supposed to do, and it wouldn't mean anything to them. But for me, mm-hmm. I couldn't throw it away because that would be like lying to my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't just give it to the kid with a bad attitude because that would feel hypocritical. So what I usually ended up doing was, if it was someone who I hadn't really paid attention to, or even if it was someone that maybe I don't think I was very nice to in the previous year, I resolved that this Valentine is going to be the first token of friendship, and things are going to be different. Which didn't always work. But by the time I was like fourth, fifth grade, I can honestly say that every person got a Valentine for me, and I wanted to give every person a Valentine. And I think it's true, because people gave me some feedback on this very thing, that everyone felt like the Valentine they got for me is one I wanted to give. So it seemed like Valentine's Day, that yearly ritual, actually sort of made me a better person. That sounds weird.
I feel like the kids from Family Circus would bully you.
But anyway, in general, it was a time to celebrate friendship. Yes, if you had a girlfriend or a boyfriend, fine. But, you know, you also appreciated your regular friends. You appreciated your family. It was a time to celebrate all of the loving connections in your life, which actually ties more into the story of St. Valentine, as apocryphal as it may be. It was about friendship and you know, the relationship between...
I thought he hugged all the snakes in Ireland.
No. No, young woman who he healed of blindness, that was his miracle, was a friend. They weren't romantically involved.
Well, but afterwards, she probably was like, hey.
No, he was like an older gentleman.
I never
gentleman,
knew you were so handsome.
She was like a kid or whatever. So it was all about friendship. But by the time you get to junior high and you're not buying Valentines for your classmates anymore, you look around and realize, oh, all this time while I've been in elementary school, for everybody else in the world, it's just about your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your spouse. And that seemed to be like, you know, that's important, but it seemed to make it less significant. Whereas it was something that I enjoyed, and like I said, I think it kind of helped make me a better person. So,
did you buy Valentines or make Valentines?
I did a little bit of both.
Ooh.
But
by and large, I made them. In my family, that was a big thing in general, homemade stuff. But mine always seemed to be just about the same thing, which were, you could get red heart-shaped paper doilies, and then I would cut out white paper hearts, and you glue the heart to the middle of the doily, and then you write your Happy Valentine's Day, whatever, on that. And then we would take some of the candy hearts, and I would glue like three or four
sure,
to each one.
Sure. That's nice.
And I took a lot of time figuring out which hearts were going to which person.
But I mean, I haven't thought about this for years, but for some reason this Valentine's Day, I'm thinking, man, it's really sad that Valentine's Day can't be this thing that you not just do things for your lover or your spouse or whatever, but you also do things for your friends and maybe your family. Like it's a like
and so to drown your sorrows, you went and saw 50 Shades of Grey?
No. No. And the, but somehow, I think the reason I was thinking about it was that there was another thing I was thinking about the next day when I listened to the podcast.
Pudding.
It's been coming up, like every single day something has come up to remind me of it. So that's why I'm going to bring it up. Is that when we talked about our fears, there was one type of very important kind of fear we didn't talk about. And that is...
skeletons.
Existential fear. Like, you know, what kind of fears do you have that are like deeply existential? Like fears of death or fears of the unknown or fears of whatever. Like my fear, my existential fear is I'm afraid that I'm actually a horrible person, but I'm too deluded or stupid to know. So I'll always just be making life horrible for everybody else, but I won't ever improve because I won't realize that I'm like deeply scarred and broken and I can't fix it.
I can appreciate that one. And in your case, it is definitely a rational one. And I know this. I'm not even saying it because I think you're so wonderful. But I know for a fact what a lot of the people in your life think of you.
Yeah, but
and therefore
I do too.
I know. That's how I know it's irrational.
There are a lot of people who have not very nice things to say about me. But that's all beside the point. But the interesting thing about this existential fear is it's kind of what a lot of the other fears, like fear of not being trusted, see, sort of spins off of that. Some of the fear of even being in crowds and stuff, because I don't know what to do, or I don't know if I'm going to offend somebody or whatever. So
you've always had a fear of sort of acting, of exerting your agency for anything because of the worry of what fallout might occur from it.
Yeah, there's that's right. That's and kind of related.
I have some of that. I've been and it still exists sometimes. I've been comparatively lucky in that I've learned what happens when I'm actually a terrible person. No, this has come up. And actually in several instances, well, not several, I guess technically twice now. No, three times. It has been a sign that I either required medication or I required an alteration to my medication. But there have been times in my life, just a handful, where multiple people from multiple different parts of my life, often who didn't know each other, would essentially come to me and say, "You're acting in this negative way," and would essentially say the same thing. And after it's been a few people, I'm like, okay, it's probably not the rest of the world.
All right, but
it's probably me. But
think about this for a second. One of my fears is that there are people out there who would have that conversation with me, but because they think I'm a total jerk, they're not going to take the time and effort to do so.
Yeah.
And again, there are people who are annoyed with me for having the values or whatever I have. There are people who don't believe that I actually have the beliefs or values I have, that I just say it so that I can get people to trust me, so that I can screw them over.
Yes, but clearly that is their problem, because you know that you actually have those beliefs.
Well, I really am convinced that I do, yeah. But what if they're right? What if I'm really some crackpot who is, because I don't want to face all my issues or my problems or whatever. Because here's the thing. Everybody has blind spots. I do too. Yeah.
And everybody has denial.
Yeah, and I don't tend to think that my blind spots are any worse than anyone else's, or that I'm psychotic because of them. But what if I am? I mean, you just don't know.
Well, that is the tricky thing. It's hard to judge your blind spots because they're your blind spots.
Exactly. Exactly. But I'm curious to know, do you have any particular existential, you know, like any particular kind of fear of death or fear of loneliness or the unknown or meaninglessness? I mean, you know, those kind of deep existential things.
Here's a weird one that I get less as I get older. I'm not sure how much impact it'll have on the listeners per se, but I know people in my life who would leap on this idea. You know, that I've had it a few times over the years, but it basically comes down to, what if fundamental Christians are right?
Oh.
What if I really am going to hell?
Oh, wow.
And I have kind of matured to the point where I'm like, if that's true, then I guess I'm going to go to the throne of judgment. I'm going to look God in the face and be like, dude, fuck you. This was a dick plan. And then I will burn for eternity. And so I'm more comfortable with it now. But that has been a thing because, it's very much an existential thing because it's not like, am I displeasing God? It's, what if my beliefs are wrong? I can't change my beliefs. What the fuck do I do about that? Mm. I mean, and fundamental Christianity is the one that I've been hit with most often, but just in general, like, you know, I have my beliefs about how I want to live my life. What if they're wrong? Because guess what? I can't change it. And it springs from nowhere. It's not like, oh, I've seen this evidence that now convinces me my beliefs are maybe wrong, because then they might change. This is just spontaneously, what if I'm that clueless and I'm just wrong about what I'm doing with my life because I can't change what I believe just spontaneously because it might be, you know?
So it's kind of similar to my thing, except what I'm worried about is my ignorance is going to make me, like, make the world a worse place no matter what I try to do, and you're worried about what might be
your... Because I'm super selfish.
No. it's both are fears, so they're both selfish when you think about it. Just, so it's not...
It's sort of... I mean, in some cases, it's again, I guess it becomes fear of God then, because I'm like, what if God is that much of an idiot?
Well, it's more fear of something but you
then,
don't know.
But then there's also the fear of, what if I'm that stupid? If it is something that is, like, really, I'm like, what if I'm just an idiot?
That's exactly the same kind of thing with me.
I used to have a lot more existential fears, but they were largely based on the fact that I was either a teenager or 20-something. A lot of things, as I got more confident in who I am and what I believe and what I do and what I want to do, a lot of those went away because I'm doing what I want to do and I'm doing what I think is right for me, and that's the best I can do.
Well, my deep existential fear is been with me my whole life, as far back as I can remember. I'm not particularly afraid of dying. I don't know when I ever was. I probably was at one time. I don't remember that. I'm not particularly afraid of being alone, because for whatever reason, you know, I never feel like I'm alone. I don't have any particular fears about the meaning of life, because I don't know, I'm like a true believer or something. It's really hard to shake my faith in the way things are, and that everything is happening for a reason. And I'm not afraid of the unknown. I'm excited by the unknown. The only thing that I'm afraid of, and the only thing I ever remember being afraid of, is that I'm not even so much afraid of not knowing myself, because that's also exciting and interesting. I'm afraid of that, of the specific thing of not knowing, specifically not knowing if maybe I'm actually a jerk and I'm never going to be able to see that, and I'm just going to make the world crappy.
I feel like... Yeah, I mean, because...
It's not something that bothers me every day or something. It pretty much only bothers me when I'm already depressed about other things. But,
well, and I feel like
it's just there.
It's very... A very specific set of circumstances has to occur for someone to be a jerk and not be aware of it.
I don't know. It seems like a lot of people are jerks and not aware of it.
There are a lot of people who are jerks and who are not aware of it. It's because like they meet those circumstances, and you don't.
Well, okay.
Because I'll tell you the other thing. One of the major aspects of the circumstances is I think you have to not be concerned at all that you might be a jerk. And I'm not saying you have to not care if you're a jerk. You have to be either not... I mean, not caring if you're a jerk is a great way to be a jerk. But... Or just be so sure that you're not a jerk. And this is the thing...
Oh, is it kind of like one of those things where if you wonder if you're crazy, you're probably not?
Well, like that? A little bit, yeah. Although I'm not sure I buy that one. No, but if you worry about how you're treating other people, and if that doesn't go away, that's the best you can hope for. And I give this advice a lot. I give this advice a fair bit to my wife because my wife is now a manager of other people, and she frequently is concerned. And I say, like, whatever the situation is, I pretty much always, because she's really good at it, I'm like, you're handling that, I think, right, and I think you're doing well. But it's very good that you're concerned and you're questioning.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's the thing. It would take a very specific set of circumstances, indeed, to wake up every morning and go, geez, am I a jerk? Nope. And then just go on with your day. Like, that level of introspection. And I mean, okay. This is another William therapy session, but I freely admit there's absolutely no way we take care of this because this is quite specifically an irrational fear and therefore cannot be treated.
Yeah, but exactly.
Think about all the stuff that has to happen for you to be a jerk. First of all, me, the person you live with, and Jazz, and a lot of people who feel that we know you pretty well and who I feel like you feel we know you pretty well have to be totally wrong.
Right. And most of the
people... We have to be idiots.
Most of the people who have bad things to say about me, I have to admit, you know, just empirically speaking, don't know me very well at all.
And full disclosure, you do shit that annoys me. Absolutely. Don't get me wrong.
No.
I don't think you're perfect, but you're absolutely not a jerk and you're a very good person. But there is another way around this. If you are simultaneously, like, that good at deceiving yourself, that, like, you've spent your whole life inventing these beliefs that are really the exact opposite of what you believe, and so good at maintaining that acting, I guess through denial, that you fooled the rest of us, too. Because it's one thing to delude yourself to that degree. Okay, it's one incredibly crazy thing to delude yourself to that. But it's another that you also fooled us. Except, like, what? The people who think you're a jerk? Because they're just the really observant ones. And they're like, we can tell. Because, come on. I can't tell. Jazz can't tell. The person you live with can't tell. But that asshole who just thinks you're annoying is like, I always knew. He may be able to fool all. Come on. I mean, come on.
Well, but also, I think I see where this is going. There comes a point where if you're convincing yourself so much that that's the kind of person you are, there has to come a point where that's actually the kind of person you are.
If you work that hard at it.
Yeah, if it looks like a duck.
In no way am I questioning that you should ask yourself if you're a jerk.
No, I know that. I know.
And don't ever get complacent.
Well, I wouldn't want to do
realize that. Well, here's the big question. And here's the question that I eventually answered that sort of, this is how I found the wealth and fame and happiness that I have now achieved. Why can't you do that? Come to my seminar. Ask yourself, are you living your life the way you want to be living it? Not the way you would like to be able to, but given your life situation, are you living it the way you want to?
Yeah, given the things that you can't change.
And the answer's never going to be unqualified yes.
No, that's right. That's right.
And if it is, that's weird. Maybe you need to broaden your horizons of how you want to be living your life. But if you use that as a marker, say, well, mostly, but here's some stuff I could change, and then you work on that stuff.
Yep.
But
yep, that's right.
As long as you're not saying, yeah, most of the way I'm living my life is fucked up, then you can feel a little okay with yourself. I mean, and that's the thing. Are there things that I wish I was doing that I'm not? Of course. Are there things that I would like to be doing that I'm probably never will? Yes. Am I too lazy to do everything? Yes. But in general, the way I live my days and the way I live my life, I'm not confused about why I'm doing that, and I don't feel bad about the decisions I'm making.
Well, as I say, it's one of those things that most existential fears, at least if you live in the West, at least if you live in the United States and you're a middle-class person, you don't think about existential fears that much. A lot of times, I mean,
or to a certain degree, you do, because you have the time to waste on
it. Well, I suppose, but they're not in your face most of the time. I mean, you know, the issues of survival, for example, just really aren't there.
Yeah.
Although a lot of people tend to like to make drama in their lives to replace the the tiger outside the cave. I don't understand that kind
of
thing.
But a lot of schools of philosophy are invented by rich white grad student dropouts. I mean,
but
when you're busy trying to survive, you don't have time for this kind of shit.
But the previous year was kind of rough, and so there was a lot of those existential fears presented themselves quite a bit.
Absolutely. We were talking about children that you raised. I mean, it's a thing. But
usually,
that's the thing. We're also talking about teenagers. Yeah. So, I'm sure there's a lot of teenagers who hate me.
as a rule, though, in my whole life, they don't really come up that much. But it is there, and that's I just thought, well, that's we didn't really cover that, and that's kind of the most interesting level of fear is that existential thing that really sort of is an engine for all of the rest of them.
And
you know?
I do feel like it's a crutch, but it's an effective one. If you're wondering about yourself, feeling unworthy and stuff, look at the people who you care about, who care about you, and say, am I saying they're wrong? Am I saying they're too stupid to realize how horrible I am?
Right.
And that can help. And that shouldn't be from whence one's self-image comes from.
No, that's
but
right.
It is a good thing to realize. Yep. And I have gained self-worth from the knowledge that Trish loves me, and she loves me a lot, and Trish is a smart lady, and so either I think she's a dumb lady, or I think she's lying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think either of those is true, so there must be something in me worth loving.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
Now, Ezzy, on the other hand.
Well, what did you want to talk about in regard to your week?
I had a gaming session.
Oh, yeah.
We ended the story involving the space station with the distress call that turned out to be a rogue AI trying to get out. I won't talk about it in too much detail, although I will say we all survived, and it was actually in question a couple times. Some pretty fucked up shit happened, but everybody got out alive. But we did have, two highlights of the episode involve... one, the woman who stayed on their ship, on the player's ship, basically successfully finding the spot to shoot with her gun to disable all the life support on the other ship.
Oh.
Because she's just that effective a shot. But the true culmination was near the end when the player, who I really thought might die because it was a mess, finally was so busted up that he basically went into cardiac arrest. And the problem being our resident medical expert, well, actually she rolled really poorly. But the other issue is that they're in vacuum. There was no air in this space station at this point. Hmm. And they're all in pressure suits. So there's no way to get like hold of him, or like you can't make contact with him. So what the fearless doctor ended up doing was giving some basic first aid instructions very quickly and frantically to her little robotic kitten helper, and then opening a seal on the suit and shoving the kitten inside and closing it up again, wherein the kitten successfully performed the instructions and resuscitated the person. Who woke up with the realization there was a robot kitten squirming around in their suit, which they couldn't get out at that point because they couldn't break the seal again, or else they would not have any air.
How interesting.
Yeah, it was quite a life-saving experience there, but it cracked us up. And I let it go because it was just creative enough. I was like, if you spend a fate point, that'll totally happen. And it did. So that was fun. I've not yet watched the season finale of Constantine, but don't tell the Nielsen people that, because we got selected. We have a diary to write down everything we watched this week, and I'm totally going to lie on it and say we've already watched it because I want to get the ratings, but we haven't actually watched it yet. I'm still playing Witcher 2, although I haven't gotten real far yet. It's a little too open-ended. I'm just going around like stealing shit out of people's cabinets and picking up new quests. I'm not actually making any progress at this point. There's too many things to do. And last night, we watched, it had been saved on the DVR, the entire 3.5-hour 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Live.
Oh. How was it?
Hit and miss, like an episode of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting to see everybody. And it sparked a lot of... there were a lot of realizations that came out of it. Some interesting conversations about plastic surgery. Because there are a lot of people. And a lot of them were old. And a lot of them have clearly had plastic surgery. And a lot of them appear to have had more subtle plastic surgery. And a lot of them have had too much plastic surgery. And a lot of them were like, did they ever have plastic surgery? And it's hard to tell. And so we discussed a lot of the sort of factors involved with that. I'm not even going to sugarcoat this. And I'm not a Beatles fan. We've discussed this before. I'm not opposed to the Beatles, but I've just never been. I understand the importance of what they did at the time they did it.
Yeah, I think you and I have the same.
Never been that into their music or anything.
Me neither.
But it was still, just because of the cultural weight of it, a terrifying experience to me, because Paul McCartney performed "Maybe I'm Amazed." Paul McCartney can't really sing anymore.
Really?
Well, to be fair, if he had just transposed it down a little bit, he would have been fine. But yeah, it was horrible.
Oh, that's too bad.
And Paul Simon performed later, and he had the guts to... Well, he had the intelligence to put it to a key he could sing. Because he's also old as fuck. But yeah, and it was just really... Like, we were just sort of stunned for a little bit as he was singing. It was really disconcerting. But, you know, he's Paul fucking McCartney, so he can do whatever he wants. I had weird pangs of missing certain people when we did talked about the people that were gone, the dead people.
Oh, like Gilda Radner.
Gilda Radner, Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks. Yeah. Jan Hooks is the really hard one for me. I miss her a lot.
Jan Hooks?
Jan Hooks, yeah.
I didn't know she's dead?
She died last year or the year before, yeah.
What happened?
It was a sickness thing. It wasn't an accident or anything.
Huh.
It was like something
I
cancer.
I did not know.
Yeah,
that.
She was only like 48 or something. Like, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I knew Phil. Phil was murdered.
Yeah.
That was really sad.
And Farley and.
Yeah, Chris Farley. Yeah.
There was a joke in the opening about it that became a running joke, and he was actually in the memoriam thing that John Lovitz was dead, and John Lovitz was alive and there. And that was the thing. Every time they did it, they would cut to him in the audience looking confused and pissed off. But they actually put him at the end of the in memoriam thing. They had shots of him, and then they cut to him, and he's like... That was pretty hilarious. And apparently, I know a lot of Saturday Night Live. Because they kept doing stuff. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember this sketch. Oh, my God, this sketch. And finally, Trish turns to me. She's like, why do you know all of these? And I'm like, apparently, I watched more Saturday Night Live than I realized.
Yeah.
Did I talk last week about they ran the first episode?
No.
Oh, yeah, they ran. Maybe it was also this week. They ran the very first episode.
Okay.
It was amazing. Because of the reason that people who know Saturday Night Live talk about it. The subversion was just there. George Carlin hosted, and George Carlin did a pretty long bit about... He didn't go so far as to talk about being no God, but that maybe God was not an immortal, infallible being. That maybe God had limitations. And he did bits like he was going to do a joke about... being searched at the airport, and he starts with saying, so you go and you get searched at the airport. Pretty soon, the government's going to be searching you in a lot of places. But right now, they just do it there, and kept going. And I was like, holy shit. And yeah, just lots of, they put in stuff that was hitting on homophobia and stuff, and just way more subversive and political than I expected.
Hmm.
Even though that's what people say. They're like, SNL used to be the subversive show, and now it's become a stop on the tour when you're famous.
Hmm.
And the musical act was Billy Preston and Janice Ian. And seeing both of them perform was pretty interesting. And just stuff like the original Andy Kaufman bit with the Mighty Mouse theme.
Yeah.
It's from that first episode. I hadn't realized.
Oh, it was in the first episode?
Yes.
Huh.
And the host basically just did stand-up bits in the middle. They had this walkout. They had like a catwalk thing that went out from the stage, and he just stood out there and did bits and then occasionally would introduce somebody, but that was it. There was not as much hosting, and he wasn't involved in like sketches and stuff. And then just weird stuff we've been finding out. Like Paul Schaefer was apparently a cast member.
Well, yeah,
I had no clue about that.
Oh yeah,
That was fun. They showed us some audition tapes, which was really fun to see, and that was interesting too because a lot of characters that came out later already existed in the audition tapes, and there was stuff that I'm like, so and so was on the show for like four seasons before they did that bit, but apparently he had in his back pocket since he auditioned.
Oh yeah,
and then there were also audition tapes that didn't make it that, as I said, probably should have. They had Zach Galifianakis, they had Jim Carrey's tape, they had a few ones that I was like, oh man. So that was kind of fun. And it was just sort of fun to see everybody. But like, there was a cast member at the reunion, on the reunion thing, because they did lots of live sketches that were usually just versions of old sketches they'd done, including the longest goddamn version of the Californians ever. I like the Californians more than most people, and that just went on for too fucking long. But they had this woman that I'm sure is from the old cast. I have no idea who she was. And she was in several things. I'm like, I don't know who that is. It didn't happen too much, but there was some of that. And stuff like they made reference to it. Do you remember first season, John Belushi did a pre-taped bit where he's really old and he goes to the not ready for primetime cemetery?
No.
It's an old black and white thing.
Never even heard of
it. It's the most fucking creepy prophetic thing ever, because the whole bit is he's the only surviving member. And they play it largely straight. Like, there's not a lot of laughs in it. The only laughs are in a couple places. He talks about how people died, and some of them are kind of funny. But, I mean, it even starts off with, he's like, yeah, they all thought I'd go first because I was live fast, die young kind of. I'm just like, I always, because I've seen it before, and I'm like, did they just get a really good John Belushi lookalike and do this later? Because it's really creepily, like, prophetic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, that's clearly not Jim Belushi. which, by the way, how sad is it to be Jim Belushi? Because basically 80% of the jobs he's ever had are quite obviously John Belushi's dead, or we would have had him, so here you go.
Probably a lot like being any of the Baldwins besides Alec Baldwin, probably a little bit like that.
I feel like that's probably
the thing. Except it would be worse if Alec was dead.
Yeah,
because they were getting cast for things that they could cast Alec for anymore. It's not even that
we can't afford him, he's dead. Otherwise, we would spare no expense to get him. And also, in the midst of this, it was a pretty sure cameo, and he was done up like Sinatra, but Joe Piscopo. They found Joe Piscopo.
What do you mean they found him?
I mean, I don't know where the fuck Joe Piscopo has been.
He's been around.
If you had asked me if he was still alive, I would be like,
He was like heavy into bodybuilding there for a long time and a few other things. I mean, he's...
Yes, we covered that. We covered that John Lovitz is dead and he's really pissed off about it. Yeah, I was like, holy shit, it's Joe Piscopo.
He was pretty
Eddie Murphy was there for 20 seconds. Like, Chris Rock did a whole big tribute to him, and then he came out and basically thanked everybody and said how happy he was to be there, and then they cut to commercial and he never came back. They got him to show up for like 20 seconds. Yeah. Kanye West did the dumbest musical performance ever. Oh, and here's fucked up. So, as I mentioned, Paul Simon was here. Miley Cyrus was also here.
Okay.
And for one of the musical bits, they did about four musical bits, probably, maybe five. Miley Cyrus performed, and she performed 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Paul Simon was not involved. He was not on stage. Nobody explained this. It starts up, and Trish knows the drum part, because it's a little variant, and Trish knows the drum part, and she recognizes it, and she turns to me, and she's like, what the hell are... They've got Paul Simon there! And it's true, he performed a song later. I mean, he'd already appeared, but he clearly didn't leave.
Yeah, yeah.
She's like, what are they doing? And I'm like, I don't know. Why would you... We've got Paul Simon. Let's have Miley Cyrus do a Paul Simon song.
Well, maybe she just decided to do it.
Well, and then, of course, at the end, Paul Simon got the last musical number. And because he did Still Crazy After All These Years, because of course he did. But he gets up there, and Trisha's like, so now he's going to go. And she's like, I bet he's going to do a Miley Cyrus song. And I'm like, no, you got to beat that joke easily. You have to get specific. He's going up there to do Wrecking Ball. Paul Simon, get up on stage, do Wrecking Ball. Then it comes. And actually, the weird thing about Miley Cyrus doing 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, Fred Armisen was on stage playing the tambourine.
And that's weird because...
because I don't think, in general, Fred Armisen is a session musician for Miley Cyrus. Particularly a session tambourine musician for Miley Cyrus. And it's not like... I mean, it's not like the time when Will Ferrell comes out in his Blue Oyster Cult thing. I mean, there was no joke. In fact, you only barely caught it, but he was clearly out there, and he played the tambourine.
And...
I'm fully aware that Fred Armisen is probably in his own mind first and foremost a musician before he is a comedian. None of that explains why the fuck he's playing tambourine for Miley Cyrus. Like, nobody with a name you recognize should ever be playing tambourine for Miley Cyrus. That's insane.
That's a rule of some kind?
I just invented it. Okay. It falls under the category of, I didn't know our society was at a point where we didn't just automatically know this, but apparently I've got to make a rule, people. So, new rule.
If, it falls into the category of things that are unfortunately too long to be the title of an episode.
I don't know. If you word it just right, you can make it work.
If anybody knows your name, you are not allowed to play tambourine, which then gets this weird race of, like, nameless mutants that are bred somewhere. We can't give them a name.
Just call it Miley Cyrus' tambourine player.
Okay.
I could play tambourine.
Absolutely. I have no idea who you are. You could do it. You could do it. Now I feel like it's the thing where you don't name animals that you're going to slaughter later. It's like that. Did you name the tambourine player? Yeah, he's Paul. Well, then he's going to be a lot harder when I kill him.
Just make him turn around. Don't look him in the eye.
That, again, one of the few Family Guy jokes that I loved. Somebody talked about a bit about things getting weird on Noah's Ark, and you cut to Noah's Ark, and there's a penguin with an elephant's head. And the penguin and the elephant are there. And I was like, well, did you name him? They go, what? It's like, does he have a name? I said, yeah, Paul. It's like, well, then it's going to be a lot harder when I throw him over the side.
Yeah, Paul.
Yep. Don't name him. Yeah, so no playing tambourine for Miley Cyrus unless you are nobody. Or William. See, I need to specify. We've talked about this. So you're allowed. You're allowed. Don't worry. But in general, it was as somebody who has apparently watched a lot of Saturday Night Live over the decades, it was fun. And honestly, probably one of my favorite bits, they did a pre-taped music video with Andy Samberg and Adam Sandler that was a power rock ballad all about breaking character. And that was pretty awesome. Talking about the circumstances, like the situations when it's too funny and it's going too well and you feel yourself get the giggles, or the other ones when it's messed up and you know if you do this you can win the audience back. And then they start doing like shots of them and they're like, but they're still singing, and they got into this whole thing where it's like, and here's one of Fallon and Sands. And then here's another one of Fallon and Sands. And here's one of Fallon and Sands. And now Fallon and Sands. I'm like, that's true. They fucking broke every single time.
That was Fallon's deal to
break. Yes, yes. Like, well, and that was a joke. Later in the song, Sandberg's like, but we never did. And Sandler's like, what? He's like, yeah, no. He's like, no, it was kind of our thing. No, we never did. No, we pretty much did every sketch. Well, and then, of course, the great joke is at the end, they finally sing the right way. They're basically singing Simply the Best, the Tina Turner song. Mm. And so they sing the whole thing with their alternate lyrics, and then for the last bit, they go, Simply the Best! And they're like, that's what that was! Oh, yeah, it's been stuck in the back of my head this whole time. I wondered what this was. So that was pretty fun to watch, too. And, I mean, and they fucking had everybody. They had everyone. I was about to start listing people, and then I'm like, holy shit, there were too many.
And they've had a lot of people over the last 40 years.
Yep, yep.
Was Steve Martin there?
Steve Martin was absolutely there. In fact, Steve Martin...
Well, Alec Baldwin should have been there.
Alec Baldwin was there. And they got into a usual debate about...
Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks was there.
Because these are guys, these are people who have hosted it a lot of times.
Yes. Well, and that got into... One of the opening things involved who should properly be hosting this because of various things, and Steve Martin's up there, and Alec came out, and he's like, you know, why didn't they pick me? Because I've technically hosted more. And then he's like, well, with this now, we're tied. And he's like, no, this doesn't count. This isn't actually, this is Sunday. And then they're like, and so other people are coming out and complaining, and they're like, what about women and stuff? Melissa McCarthy came out because she was mad about that. At a certain point, Paul McCartney and Paul Simon came out and says, what about musicians named Paul? Yeah, they had some, and then just people who I think just wanted. The audience was fucking insane. I saw George Lucas in the audience.
Really?
Yes. And Michael Douglas was in the audience, and he actually got a bit because there was some question thing, and he. Oh yeah, Jerry Seinfeld did a question answer thing that was hilarious, and it had one with Michael Douglas that is like, why didn't I host more? I'm pretty famous, why? And so he tried to explain why that was. And then John, he says, you know, it's really about availability. So not hosting is really the bigger compliment. Like, if you host too much, that just means that you don't have anything going on. And then John Goodman stands up and he's like, what do you mean? I hosted 13 times. He's like, no, John. And then Larry David stands up and they do a bit that hurt me in my heart because... They're talking about how you do it. Is like, can you believe we're here? And he's like, did you know that we used to write? I used to write for them. And he's like, yeah, I did. He's like, I remember that. Because he was a writer for like one season.
Okay.
And he's like, and now we went on to make the biggest show ever. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, and with the media landscape the way it is now, nobody could ever do that again. And Seinfeld's like, yeah, no, that couldn't happen. We're kind of like, we got the last two tickets to Disneyland before it burned down. He's like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. That is true, and that is sad, and that is really mean of you to bring that up.
The last two tickets to Disney.
Yes, and then Ellen Klinghorn stood up to ask why there weren't more black women. And Seinfeld, you said, you mean on Saturday Night Live? And she said, no, I mean in the world. She said, sometimes I go to the dentist, and there's just like one or two black ladies in the waiting room. Why aren't there... Like, wouldn't it be awesome if just, like, more just, like, showing up, like, popping out of drawers and stuff like this? It was surreal, and it was really kind of fun. I enjoyed watching it. I think I would recommend it to people. If you ever liked Saturday Night Live, because people love to shit on Saturday Night Live, and I've finally come out the other side, where I'm like, you know what? Saturday Night Live is always some good and some bad. Take your favorite sketch ever and watch the Saturday Night Live episode that it's from, and I guarantee you there's at least four sketches in there that you think suck.
Well, I mean, it's live television. Well, I mean, they do a lot of pre-recorded stuff now, but...
Yeah, well, and actually, Louis C.K. was announcing the pre-recorded stuff, and he was talking about, this is the best part, this is the part that everybody loves, not the live stuff. They really should just stop doing that.
Recently, it is... that's true, I think, in the last several years.
There were a surprising number... They've always done a lot.
No, I know they have, but... If you go into the first 20 years, the things that people like the most are not usually the pre-recorded stuff.
No, but there is like White Like Me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a classic one there. And I just recently, the Show Us Your Guns bit is from the first episode. So I just saw that recently. And I was just talking about the thing with the Not Ready for Primetime Cemetery. And they sneak in. You don't think of them as much, but I do think you're right. I think nowadays it's become, well, because it's stuff like Lonely Island, and I think there are certain people who really, like Andy Samberg, just did that stuff, and so Lonely Island came out of that, and the Laser Cats ones came out of that.
Well, and then those things become viral, which, yeah, you didn't used to have that.
Exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, it's a whole new thing, but a lot of stuff's still live.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is when you really take that into account, and if you've ever done any performance, you can be really sympathetic to when things don't quite work out or when things go really well and how amazing that is.
And there were a couple of flubs in the, like, this was live too. And there were some spots where you noticed. And then there was stuff that was supposed to be. There were jokes like Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey announced some section. Oh, no, they talked about Tracy because Tracy Morgan couldn't be there because he's still recovering.
Oh, really? I didn't know he was still
out of it.
That's been a long time ago that happened.
Yeah. But it was brain injury. So, yeah, he's still working on it.
That's too bad.
But when they announced them, he was in a car accident, in case you don't know.
In a car accident.
You were looking at me, and I'm like, duh, I know. That's why I'm telling you. But then I realized, oh, yeah, we're recording this.
But this has been over a year ago now, or a year?
It's been last late spring, I think. So not quite a year, I don't think. I don't know for sure, though.
So, yeah, in case listeners don't know, he was in a pretty horrific accident. The other person in the car with him was killed.
Yeah.
Who was also a comedian, I think, right?
Or I think so. Somebody. But not somebody I'd heard of.
But wow, I didn't know he was still recovering.
Yeah, he's still working. Well, yeah, because it did some serious head trauma.
It was horrific.
And other trauma, but I mean, he's having cognitive issues.
Huh.
But anyway, now this is way less funny because of what we just talked about. Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey were starting that section when they came back from Christmas, and the announcer announced them as Mr. and Mrs. Alec Baldwin. It's like, wait, what? And again, John Lovett's dead the whole time. As he's going into her little hidey hole. I have to tackle this soon. I told you I was reading that comic book Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Well, there are 10 volumes. My friend lent me all of them, and I couldn't read them at the time, so I just put it on the pile, and the pile has grown. And so a while back, I went looking, and I could find number 1 and number 2. So I'm like, well, I can at least start. But I couldn't find any more. I did some more spelunking, and I found 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And now I've finished 1 and 2. I just finished 2 last night. So I'm like, well, now I'm fucked. So this weekend, going to have to do a serious deep dive for number 3 and number 4. Otherwise, I got this pile of them that I can't even read. We have less than 10 minutes. Should we maybe
do
a thing? Sorry for all those people I lied to about how the show is, but I tell lies, so deal with it. I've come to terms with it. Why can't you? Stop pestering me. What do you got?
What's a nice holiday memory you have? Any holiday.
Don't talk about Valentine's.
I already did. I've already answered this question. Boom!
I like... There was a year when my uncle Eric, just so people know, is the one I remind everyone of. First of all, I'm built kind of like him. I'm a big guy. Mm. A lot of my build, you can trace to him. But also, I've been the jokester in the family always. I would tell jokes and people were like, oh my God, that totally sounds like something Uncle Eric would say. But one year at Christmas, back when my grandparents still had the big house and everything, so everybody was there in this giant house, and we had the huge dining table, and we're all sitting down. He said it was time, and we needed to sing Christmas carols around the table, as was tradition. Except...
It wasn't tradition?
It was not. And here's the thing. As near as we can tell, he wasn't joking. Because he seemed quite surprised and embarrassed when we pointed this out. And he's like, really? We don't do that? And we were like, no. And he's like, I thought we sang. And it was the Christmas song, the Nat King Cole one. And so we sang it. And it was weird. Because we had never done that before. But it cracked us all up, including him. And he's like, this is the first year we do. But it's him, so it totally could have been a joke, too. But it was like, we never do that. No, we never. We've literally never done that. Like, oh, well, we should. So we did.
Oh, man.
We also had Find the Pickle at Christmas. You ever do Find the Pickle?
Well, I've heard of it. No, we've never done it.
It's a thing. It's a tradition, I don't know, from old Prussians or something. I don't know.
Actually not. A lot of people think that, but I
some shit some dude made up in the 60s?
No, it's older than that, but it's
50s
American, and it's like Boy, I don't remember. When I first heard of it, I looked it up, and the article I read said that a lot of people think it's, you know, from quote unquote the old country, but it isn't. It's older than, like, I mean, it might go back to the mid 1900s or something. It might be that old, but it's American. All right.
Tell me the tradition as you know.
Oh, the tradition as I understand it is there's an ornament,
okay,
that is on the tree that is the shape of a pickle or something, and whoever finds it gets a special gift or something. I don't remember all that.
Wow, we're not fucking it up. Okay.
Well, and you can get glass ornaments that look like pickles, so that seems really German, you know, and you can put it on your tree somewhere.
And in my mind, I assume it's an old tradition that involved an actual pickle.
No.
Because I'm like back in the day. But what we have is one of those shaped, like really thin metal, like the aluminum ornaments.
It's not of glass. A pickle.
No, this one's a thin, like the thin shaped metal.
Okay.
Ones that I think of as sort of old timey looking metal ornaments.
Okay.
It's a pickle. And yeah, it's somewhere on a tree. And in my family, we decorate the fuck out of trees. So it can be hard to find. And the first person to find it gets a prize, which in our family, I think the first year we realized we didn't have a prize or something. I don't know. The first year was different. But since then, whoever houses Christmas, whoever's house we're having it at or whatever, has prepared. And the prize is always the same thing. A jar of pickles.
A jar of pickles.
A jar of pickles. That's the prize. Because it's apropos and it's very low stakes. So it never gets overly competitive, you know. Yeah, so you have a jar of pickles. And the first year, crack this all up, and now it's just the way it goes.
I could go on and on and on with holiday memories, but I will tell one.
All right. Is it yours?
Yeah.
You didn't learn it from the Animus?
One. All right. Halloween.
One Halloween. I feel like the lamest hype man ever sometimes when you tell a story. I'm over here, like, back in my room. One Halloween.
Oh, now I'm thinking of a whole bunch of other Focus, cool Halloween stories.
Stay on target.
Okay.
Stay on target.
I'll try to keep for the one I was going to tell. Okay. So, we live out in the country, right?
I've heard that.
When we don't go into town to for Halloween.
We always holler on the radio, Tonto, don't go to town.
No, we do not go to town. We just go to houses that are out in the country where we live.
All right.
And one year, we went to a house that we always went to. This was a friend's of my grandmother. It was an older lady, my grandma's age, and her two spinster daughters lived in this house.
Ooh, I hope this is going to be a spooky story. I feel like it's a spooky story.
It's not spooky.
And at the end they said, son, that house has been condemned for 25 years.
They died a long time ago. No.
And his Letterman jacket was on the gravestone.
Oh, man, your story's a lot better than my story. Okay, anyway, I'll finish my story.
Okay, go ahead. So, yes. So, old lady, two spinster daughters, house out in the middle of nowhere.
This house doesn't exist anymore. It actually was torn down after they all passed away.
No one else will admit it ever did exist.
But anyway, we went there, and nobody else ever visited their house for Halloween. We were the only ones. Now, there are five kids in the family, but for whatever reason, they always had a ton of candy. But I think usually they just saved it for the next year. But this year, they decided, you know what? You kids are the only ones that showed up, so we're just going to give you all the candy. So we all got...
Oh, my goodness.
We all got these huge packages of...
Is this like old-timey candy? Is it just all ribbon candy?
No, they were full, not even bite-size, full-size Butterfingers in like a 12-bar pack.
Holy crap.
We each got one. That
Did they
was awesome.
Come with insulin?
That was Jeez, awesome.
That is pretty awesome.
Somehow, I don't remember all the houses we went to. I mean, they were just out in the country there. But we just had those small plastic buckets shaped like jack-o'-lanterns, you know?
Yeah.
And we'd fill it up, though. I mean, all the kids we knew in town would have shopping bags full of candy and stuff. Yeah. All we ever had were those little things.
At a certain point, it's like, as I've taught many times, the whole thing where above a certain household income anymore and your happiness doesn't increase. I feel like it's the same with kids and Halloween candy.
Probably.
They think it's cool, but at a certain point, even kids are like, oh my God. But I find this.
But we always filled them. I don't know where we went to fill those things.
Here's the deal. We're fucking Americans, and one thing that means is candy is cheap.
Hell yeah.
why don't we bribe kids more? Like, you could go to the store and spend $3 and make a kid love you for years. Just give them a 12-pack of Butterfinger.
It does not work like that. Because it's like any kind of thing, an incentive thing. This is the same with adults. It's the same with anybody, anytime. You get something for someone as an incentive, and it'll work once or twice. But then the price goes up. Because then it's like...
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, this is what you always give me to do this thing. I need more. I need a little
more. Is this what happened with this old lady? Eventually, you were like, No. Let's get more.
It was a total surprise, and we were like...
2 weeks later, he stabbed that old lady in the eye.
But you know what? Another cool thing about this... Because she wouldn't give him any more candy. This, now that I'm thinking about it, this lady was the one... She had a kiln.
Pronounced limp.
Is that what they call them? Kilns where you fire...
Children?
No. Well, they could have, I guess. It was pretty big.
You don't call it a kiln when you do that.
Ceramics and stuff.
Yeah, that would be.
That's where my grandma went and made ceramics stuff. She made all kinds of ceramic stuff. We have some of it in the house now, but yeah, that's where she went to do that. And I remember it was out in they had a sort of a front porch, not an open front porch, but you know, closed in front porch. And the kiln was out there sitting on bricks and stuff. And they had shelves of unfinished. Ceramic stuff.
Okay,
And you know what? Now that I'm thinking about it some more, we'd go there often to, like, make stuff. As kids and stuff. That was pretty fun.
Have you ever seen any of my grandfather's ceramic stuff?
I don't think so.
We've got a lot around here. I'll have to show you sometime. Actually, that really dusty blue thing on the table there is his. It's gorgeous stuff. Here's the thing. He's making it for years. It's just a hobby he has, and it's gorgeous. They finally moved to the nursing home. Actually, at the time, it was just the retirement home. But the point is, they stopped living independently. And so the young people have to go through the house because there's not enough. There's too much stuff. Mm. You know, it's not going to fit in the little apartment they got at the retirement home. Mm-hmm. And so we go out to... He had a workshop because they built this house. When they moved out of the big one, they built a house for themselves. And they're still filthy rich at this point. So it's a giant house for two people. So, like, it only has one bedroom, but that bedroom is bigger than my house. Like, it's, you know, huge thing. So, next to, like, the three-car garage, for which they only own two cars, he had a whole workshop with a potter's wheel and a kiln and everything. Yeah, yeah. And so, they're going through all this, and he's got all this stuff. And they come across this one thing, and they're like, what is that? And the label says, uranium.
Oh, yeah.
And they call him at the retirement home, and they're like, what is this? He's like, oh, that's uranium.
Yeah, to make, like certain green...
What?
Certain greens come from uranium.
Yes, and he had the permits and everything.
Oh, yeah.
But this is the thing, because he's a chemist by trade.
Oh, okay.
And so that was sort of how he got in pottery, was what he could do with cool laser. So you can see it now. But they were like, what? Like, they had to find out so much stuff about how do we get rid of this uranium that we found in the garage.
Oh, yeah. Yep. It's used to make certain shades of green.
The point
green,
is,
hues of green.
I sold it to Iraq. And then later... No, sorry. That's a terrible joke.
Now the FBI... Hey, actually, this is good. The FBI is going to start listening to the podcast, and it's horrible, so some FBI people are going to quit, probably.
Have you seen the YouTube thing about if Google was a guy?
No.
People go to... If Google was a guy, there's three of them in a row. Trish just showed them to me yesterday. They are hilarious. The whole thing is Google's just this guy you go and you ask the stuff to. Mm-hmm. Hilarious. Check him out. Everybody, check him out. If Google was a guy, check him out. We're way over time, so...
I got a ton of cool holiday stories. So.
We know.
Well, maybe not cool
holiday. Yeah, I was going to say cool is
cool
in air quotes. Yeah.
Cool to me holiday stories.
But we're going to spare you all because we like you, so come back next week, and I'll try to keep him from telling any holiday stories. And I'll try and stop myself from talking about Saturday Night Live. In the meantime, know that we love you, and then that's all that you need, because food and water are illusions. The love of our podcast will sustain you through all things. I started creeping myself
out. Not to be construed as medical advice.
Midway through that sentence, I started creeping myself out a little bit. Sorry for that, people. Go about your business, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yep.
yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.